It was a hot summer evening in the Churva Shul, which followed the course, I guess you could say, of the Medrash that describes the world as being banui, built, charev, destroyed, and banui, and then rebuilt. As you know, that today you can go to Yerushalayim and see this beautiful, magnificent, rebuilt Churva Shul in the Old City, but it was destroyed for a long time. But go back a little over 100 years, and it was a summer evening in the Churva Shul, and people were seated on the benches. There's no air conditioning, of course, so everybody's tied together in Yerushalayim in the summertime. And there was a speaker standing in the front of the shul, and it was, you know, somewhat dim. It was hard to see exactly who was there. It was crowded. And then someone started screaming in the middle of the talk. And then other people were screaming, ah! Oy, ah! Ooh! Ah! And it became a tremendous bahala. It became almost a panic in the shul, in the Churva Shul. People started screaming and looking and running. And the entire event, the speech that was going on, it stopped because there was total chaos. In Rav Yitzchak Nissenbaum was a Mizrahi magid, teacher, preacher in Europe. He describes this event, and he says that what had happened, the reason why people were screaming, was because there were a few people, somebody had taken a needle and was walking behind the seats of the people in shul and sticking them with needles. What? You hate it when that happens. So, I'm like, you're trying to picture this. In the summer of 1904, in the Churva Shul, there were people who were running around the back of the shul, going in between the chairs and sticking people with needles to the point where they were screaming. They ran out of shul, and they stopped. They stopped the asifa because this was a gathering of a eulogy for Theodor Herzl. I like that noise. That was like a good sound effect. I don't know if they caught that on the recording. The collective. So you're not surprised that there were people, Olenu Jews, we can call them Kanoim, and this is the way that Rav Shmuel Salant, who was the very, very elderly chief rabbi of Yerushalayim from the Yishuv HaYashan, he described these people who are so extreme that they were sticking people with needles to disrupt the hesped for Herzl, the eulogy for Herzl. So it seemed to me that this was a good controversy for us to think about, the week of Chai Sara, first hesped of all time. Now that hesped was probably, you know, probably one of the most iconic hespedim, because the Medrash describes that the hesped for Sara Imenu was the original Eishes Chayil. And I think, I don't go to so many levayas as Kohen, but I think there are many times when there's a levaya for all women, people recite Eishes Chayil. But that's the original hesped, the Medrash says, was Eishes Chayil for Sara Imenu. Vayavo Avram lispod l'sara v'livkosa. Because the hesped, a eulogy, is a very powerful moment. It's a very powerful life cycle moment in halacha. And at the same time, because of that, because of the sensitivity around hespedim, it can be very controversial. Take the case of our Zionist figure. I don't know if his neighbors called him Ted, but they could have. Theodor Herzl, Hamachuna Binyamin Zev. Theodor Herzl, when he died on July 3rd in 1904 in Vienna because of cardiac complications, He was only 44 years old. He became, during his short life, the most recognized and perhaps influential leader of the Zionist movement, which paved the way, undoubtedly, of course, for the modern state of Israel. He was a great Zionist leader, but he was also highly assimilated, and he considered himself assimilated. And initially, he actually thought that assimilation is going to solve the problem that Jews faced of persecution and all kinds of difficulties, and then he realized that that's not going to help. Now, he didn't remember this from the pasuk of Heinan Levodad Yishkod, but he intuited that that's not going to work, so instead, he figured out that we need a homeland. He was a journalist, so some of you are familiar that he covered the Dreyfus Affair, and he was moved to this idea to reach out to heads of state and create a movement to building a place, a homeland, a state for Jews, what we call today the State of Israel. So he reached out to Kaiser Wilhelm and the Emperor of the Ottoman Empire, the Sultan, and in 1897 he inaugurated the first Zionist Congress. So this is, you could argue, the founder of modern Zionism. At the same time, when he lived in Vienna, he was visited once. He writes about being visited in December by the chief rabbi of Vienna, who was a little bit disturbed to see that he was lighting a Christmas tree. And he notes in his journal, he says, yeah, the rabbi was there, but I was not going to be deterred just because of his presence to light the Christmas tree for my children. So he was unquestionably not a religious man. He did not observe what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. And the problem is that when you have someone, like all of us have complexities, but when you have someone on that level of stature and prominence who is not just not religious, but maybe even could be considered or construed as anti-religious, could become a very polarizing and controversial figure. So on the one hand, there was a prominent Rosh Yeshiva in Telz who delivered a hesped. His name is Rev Elia Kaplan. I don't know if any relation. He died in 1924. In 1919, when he was in Telz, he delivered a hesped where he describes, it wasn't formally a hesped, but he remarked about Herzl, that he did not teach us Torah, he did not teach us Halacha or Agada, he did not teach us any Jewish studies nor Musar, as he was never taught these subjects. He was raised in surroundings where this knowledge did not exist. However, he taught us two words that we never dared to pronounce from the pasuk in Yonah. Ivri Anochi. I am a Hebrew. In our Beis Medrash, we could make this claim. We could even write it in our newspapers, but there was one place which we could not, in the international arena. Herzl taught us what we know today, to stand tall and proud before the world and demand our right to return to our homeland. But the majority of Torah voices were not in agreement with that view of Herzl, who was undoubtedly a secular person. Rab Chaim HaLevi Soloveitchik. Rab Chaim was the rabbi in Brisk. When Herzl died in July, he sent a message to the Gabbai, who went to lock the shul. Why do you think he sent the message to lock the shul? To make sure that nobody would dare open it to make a memorial service. Well, you know who else lived in Brisk in 1904? A man by the name of Dov Zev Begin, who was murdered in the Holocaust, but his son is known to us, the late great tzaddik Menachem Begin, Zecher Tzaddik Levracha. So Menachem Begin's father lived in Brisk. He talks a lot about that. Menachem Begin's father went to the shul, took an axe, and smashed open the door. And they had a ragtag group of people, so they had a shtickel memorial service for Menachem Begin in the shul in Brisk after Reb Chaim had told them to lock the door. They weren't allowed. For Herzl, I'm sorry. Because Reb Chaim said, it's absolutely wrong. It says in Shulchan Aruch, in Simen Reish Mem He, in Yoredeya, that a person who is a mumer, which we could spend many hours determining what that looks like, but maybe one could argue that Herzl was a mumer, a rasha, a non-halachically observant person. Christmas tree totally abandoned all remnants of observance, of strict religious practice. So you cannot eulogize such a person. Yeah. Okay, good. So that's helpful. I'm not an expert on Herzl, so it could be that maybe from a policy standpoint, he was not anti-religious, but certainly I would say that the way that he was viewed in the majority of the Torah establishment, because the Zionist movement had many elements in it which were vocally anti-religious, because many of those people, because of a whole host of reasons, they viewed actually Zionism as supplanting Judaism, and certainly halachic Judaism, and that this was an alternative. So even if he himself wasn't anti-Zionist, he could be, right or wrong, lumped together with leading a movement which was certainly, in certain camps, considered to be anti-Zionist, even if he personally wasn't. Right, anti-religious, I should say, excuse me. So, you know, he wasn't a religious person, and he was kind of in a chevra of people, some of whom were outspokenly anti-religious. I don't have enough scholarship to know whether or not his views were particularly religious or anti-religious. And also, when you talk about people, it's also just important to note that sometimes people's views change over time. So you have to really look at the scope of his writings over the course of his life and figure out at what points did he hold what opinion. So I don't know enough about that. All I can tell you is that when he died, and it was not expected, it was a shock to the Jewish world. So now the controversy that you've been waiting for. Because this was in July, in Tammuz of 1904, just a few weeks earlier, who arrived in Israel? A revolutionary figure. A man who had been a rabbi in Europe, in a few small towns first, a place called Zoymel and then Boisk. Before that, he was one of the top students in Voloshin, a brilliant, extraordinary thinker and spiritual giant. His name was Rav Avram Yitzchak HaKohen Cook. Rav Cook arrives in Yafo on the 28th of Iyar, 1904. People like to note, it's easier to remember that Rav Cook arrived in Yafo on the date that was going to later become... That's right, Yom Yerushalayim. That's the way to remember. The day that Rav Cook arrived in Israel was on Yom Yerushalayim. It was on Chaf Ches Iyar. So, Rav Cook arrives. There are placards welcoming Rav Cook to Yafo. He's going to become the chief rabbi of Yafo. And Rav Cook already had a distinct and unique vision of Yahadus, of Judaism, which he was already expressing publicly somewhat, but also a lot more in his diaries, which are now called, they're collected, they're called Shmoneh Kvatzim, the eight journals that Rav Cook kept personally in Europe. Rav Cook had this vision and an understanding and a perspective. What he saw was the potential for value in the secular Zionist establishment. Now, Rav Cook was not naive, and Rav Cook was actually, over the course of his life, was very critical, and I mean critical in the sense that he looked carefully at every program, every political party, every initiative, and tried to understand and see what elements of it are acceptable in a Torah context and which are not acceptable. And he was not afraid to speak out against things that he did not agree with in the Mizrahi movement, which was started later. The Mizrahi movement was started in 1903. Certainly, Keren Kayemet, there's a whole book, I think it was written by, you remember, there was a Rav, I think it was authored by him, Rav Eitan Henkin, Hashem Yikom Tomo Zchus Yom Aleinu. He was the son of Rav Henkin. He was killed with his wife in a drive-by shooting. So he was a Mechaber Svarim. I think one of his Svarim is on this topic, on Rav Kook's relationship with Keren Kayemet. Keren Kayemet was a secular Zionist organization, and Rav Kook spoke out about many of the things that he did not agree with them, including one that Mirz Hashem later this year, we're going to get to it when we get to Parshas Bahar, we talk about Shemitah and the Heter Mechira. Rav Kook wrote a letter about Keren Kayemet places that were not observing Shemitah, even according to the Heter Mechira. He was critical of that. Rav Kook was very understanding of the reality. But at the same time, Rav Kook, he came to Israel with a new set of understandings of the world through his appreciation of Yiddishkeit that was distinct from what we could call the Yishuv Hayashan, the old traditional perspective on Yiddishkeit, which Elu Ve'elu Devar Elokim Chayim, which we spoke about. There are different ways of looking at this. Now, even Rav Shmuel Salant, who was anti-Zionist, he said, look, people stabbing people with needles in a hesped, that's not Elu Ve'elu Devar Elokim Chayim. But Rav Shmuel Salant, you know, in the Yishuv Hayashan, the old Yishuv, the old settlement, anti-Zionist. Rav Kook arrives in 1904. That's the beginning of what they call in history, the history books, they call that Aliyah Shnia. In the 1880s, that was the Aliyah Rishona, first big wave of European immigrants. And then in 1904 is the second big wave of European immigrants who are coming to Israel. Rav Kook is coming to Yafo. He settles there and he becomes friends with a whole group of local Zionist intellectuals and writers. One of those guys, young man, who at that time was, you could count him for a minion, but I don't say he was in shul every other day. His name was Shai Agnon. At that period in his life, Shai Agnon was, from a spiritual, religious standpoint, he was a very deep spiritual person, but from a religious standpoint, he was kind of lost a little bit for a tekufa. He wasn't always religious. At the end of his life, he was, you know, when he spoke in front of the whole Nobel audience, he wore a beautiful yarmulke, he made a huge Kiddush Hashem, but for a period of time, when he was in Yafo, that was not a tekufa in his life when he was particularly religious. Rav Kook befriended him and many others, because people understood that when Rav Kook was coming, he was bringing a new perspective of Yiddishkeit. Same sources, same Masora, from a Hasidic upbringing, Lithuanian trained in Volozhin, but a particular appreciation of the Yishuv HaChadash, the new Yishuv. Okay, so now what happens? Rav Kook gets a knock on the door, and two guys approach him. They say they are here to invite Rav Kook to speak at a memorial service for Herzl. Going to be taking place that week in the Jaffa branch, in the Yafo branch of the Anglo-Palestine Company. The Anglo-Palestine Company is the name of a bank, a large bank, so they had a hall. Think about like the old school banks with, you know, nice sized buildings with big rotunda. There's going to be a gathering in the bank. This bank is, of course, connected to the Yishuv, to the new settlement. There were two delegates, local, you know, leaders who were going to speak, and they wanted Rav Kook, the new rabbi of the city, to come and speak at the Hesped, at the memorial service for Herzl. So what do you do? What do you do when you're faced with this dilemma? So Rav Kook writes a letter. You can get the English translation of this letter and some of the historical background in this excellent book. It's translated by Bezalel Naor. It's called When God Becomes History, Historical Essays of Rav Aaron Yitzchak HaKohen Kook. You see Rav Kook pictured here in the middle with his trademark spodik, a very tall spodik. Rav Kook wrote a letter to the Aderet. The Aderet is a nickname for Aleph, Dalid, Resh, Tav, Rav Elio, David Rabinowitz to Umim, that was the name of his father-in-law. His father-in-law was a well-known Gaon who was like the, he was the successor to be of Rav Shmuel Salant. The thing is that Rav Shmuel Salant lived till like 170. He lived like so long that when the Aderet arrived from Europe in Israel, he was a rabbi, I think, in Ponovich. He arrived in Israel to kind of be the next in line for Rav Shmuel Salant. He was Rav Shmuel Salant's assistant chief rabbi of Yerushalayim for like 30 years. I don't even remember who died first. If Rav Shmuel Salant died first or the Aderet predeceased. But Rav Aderet was a well-known gaon in Europe. Rav Kook, his first wife, died when he was much younger. And then he had a second wife that was the daughter of the Aderet. So he wrote a letter to the Aderet to explain to him what he was going to do or what he did. The letter was a week later. But in this letter to the Aderet, Rav Kook explains what he was thinking. He says, look, I was faced with a conundrum. He writes this letter on the 29th of Tammuz. Herzl died on the 20th of Tammuz. He said, on the one hand, when these people came to talk to me, the memorial service was a fait accompli. It wasn't like they asked my opinion if they should make a memorial service. It was happening. He says, on the other hand, I don't want to be maspid someone who, you know, doesn't conform to the values that we espouse. On the third hand, he says, I can tell you, even in my short time here, he says, I went to visit Rehovot. I went to Rehovot. Now, today, Rehovot, you go there, it's Ir Ve'en B'Yisrael, there's lots of religious people there. He says, at that time, Rehovot, it was mostly irreligious farmers. And Rav Kook says, I went there. And I'll tell you what I did not do. I did not bang them over the head with a copy of the Shulchan Aruch, especially, you know, one of the big ones, the old traditional, you know, the Gross brothers or the Pollock brothers, MP. I didn't hit them over the head. I spoke to them words of love and encouragement about building the land of Israel. And I built a rapport with them. And my hope is that as I build a rapport with people and I can connect with them, I can be mashpi on them, I can influence them to find a different path, that they should appreciate Yiddishkeit, that they shouldn't be some of the people that came from Europe and they were mamish anti. So Rav Kook says, what's going to happen? If I, the chief rabbi, I say I'm not going to go, it's going to make a big statement. It's not just going to go unnoticed. And it's not just going to be that people are not going to pay attention. Adrabah, how are people, the local folks, the people who, for right or wrong, better or for worse, they idolize Herzl. Well, how are they going to feel about me? And he says, not just how are they going to feel about me, how are they going to feel about rabbis and B'nai Torah and Yiddishkeit in general? What are going to be the effects of that? He says, I'll tell you exactly. He writes the letter to the Aderet. Aderet was in Yerushalayim. He says, I can tell you, I can see, only a few weeks, I'll tell you what's going to happen. It's going to cause tremendous enmity. It's going to be much more damaging. I'll put a bisograyim in parentheses. Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zecher Tzadik, Mekadosh Levracha. Shlomo Zalman, you know, he was the Rosh Hashiva of Kol Torah. He died in the early 90s. So, Shlomo Zalman once had a visitor. This is also interesting and controversial story. But it's important to understand what Rav Kook was talking about. But it's much later. I don't remember if this took place in the 70s or the 80s, but it appears in the Mincha Shlomo, I think. The story is that there was a guy who came to visit Kol Torah, which the yeshiva still exists in Bayit Vegan. You can go there. A guy comes to Kol Torah, a potential donor, whatever, he's coming to visit the place, and he's not a religious person. So he's there for a meeting, and Rav Shlomo Zalman is meeting with him, and Rav Shlomo Zalman goes tells one of the Bachrim to go get him a cup of water, get cold water. The Bachrim was surprised because there is a din in the Shulchan Aruch, an often a din in Shulchan Aruch, that you are not allowed to serve food to someone who's not going to recite a bracha because you are placing a stumbling block in front of them. You put food in front of them, they're going to eat the food, and then what's going to happen? They're not going to make a bracha. And the Gemara says at the beginning of brachas that a person eats without making a bracha, it's almost like kiviyoch, it's like taking something that's not ours from the Ribbono Shel. It belongs to the Ribbono Shel, and then we can eat it when he gives us permission. Rosh Hashanah says, you get this man a cup of water, you don't ask, you don't do, you just run. So they got the cup of water. The man left later. And they asked Reb Shlomo Zalman, they said, Rebbe, how could you serve this man a cup of water? You knew he wasn't going to make a bracha with certainty. Shlomo Zalman says, yeah, but you know, in Yerushalayim in the summertime in Kol Torah, it's pretty warm here. Did you notice? We didn't have air conditioning. This man, he's used to being treated like a mensch. What kind of manners is it that a person comes to a place and they don't give him a cup of cold water when it's hot? Comes for a meeting, it's totally disrespectful. So Shlomo Zalman says, it's true. On the one hand, you face the problem of giving someone to drink that's not going to make a bracha. But on the other hand, you know what's going to happen if they don't have an offer that has any decency, any menschlichkeit. You know what's going to happen? That person is going to walk away and say, these people are boors. They're rude. They're insensitive. What kind of Bein Adam L'Chaveiro is this? A man comes for a meeting, you invite him for a meeting, you don't offer him a drink. He says, forget the fact that he's not going to have a high opinion of anyone in this room, but he's going to think that Torah Jews are totally insensitive. He's going to come to totally resent from people. Shlomo Zalman says, that's a lot worse than him not making a bracha. And that's why you have to give him a drink. So Rav Kook says, if I don't go to this memorial service, people are going to look at me and they're going to basically write me off. I'm not going to have any impact, and people are going to hate me. So what do you do? What does Rav Kook do? Well, the answer is in your hand. Because you are holding the talk that Rav Kook gave. We're not going to go through the entire thing. There are two sections here in your packet. There is the Hebrew, which is in the front, and then there is the rest of it in the English, which you have to thank Mitzal Naor, because the English comes from here. So I invite you to follow along and listen carefully to what Rav Kook does in this talk. He mentions something in the letter to the Aderet, which I'm going to note afterwards, which I want you to keep an eye out for, although it's hard to keep an eye out because we're not going to read the whole thing. Let's start at the beginning. Bayomahu Yigdal Hamispe Birushalayim. You can read in the English if you want. On that day, the eulogy in Yerushalayim will be great. Kemispeid Hadad Rimon Bevikas Megiddo. Like the eulogy for Hadad Rimon in the valley of Megiddo. How many of you have heard of the eulogy for Hadad Rimon in the valley of Megiddo? The answer is none of you. Thankfully, because it didn't exist. This is a pasuk in the book of Zechariah. Now, Zechariah in general is such a cryptic book, ad kedei kach, that Zechariah the Navi himself gets visions and he says, I don't know what I'm seeing. So if you ever learn Zechariah and you don't know what you're seeing, you're in good company. Because Zechariah himself doesn't know what he's seeing. So the pasuk says in Zechariah, this is going to be a tremendous eulogy. The eulogy of Hadad Rimon Bevikas Megiddo. So the Gemara says in Megillah, what that is. So the Gemara says, you know, Yonasan ben Uziel, the famous commentary, the great Tana Eloki, he wrote a commentary, and the Gemara says that the world shook from his commentary because he revealed secrets of the Torah. So this pasuk, he unpacked it. It's actually not one eulogy. It's two eulogies. It's a eulogy referencing Hadad Rimon. Hadad Rimon was a foreign king who killed a Jewish king, a Melech Yisrael, named Achav. Achav, you would not associate with one of the great, you know, heroes of Jewish history. He would not be on your pantheon of great Jewish kings, but he was a Melech Yisrael. So Achav was killed by Hadad Rimon. That's the first reference in this cryptic pasuk in Zechariah, according to Yonasan ben Uziel, the Halakha of Yonasan ben Uziel. And who died Bevikas Megiddo? King Yoshiyahu. That's the secret. That's what Rabbi Yonasan ben Uziel says. That's what the Gemara explains. So Rav Kook opens with a reference to a eulogy that the Gemara says has to do with Achav and Yoshiyahu. Hold that thought. He's going to come back to it later. Says Rav Kook, Vihine. If you go to the third paragraph in the Hebrew here, follow with me. I'll read it out and translate freely, but you can read in the English if you want. I don't know what paragraph it is in English. Vihine, here, Chazal Omru, Chazal said, Shehesped ze, this eulogy, yiye it will be, al Mashiach ben Yosef sheneherag. On Mashiach ben Yosef, who will be killed. What's that? Well, Mashiach ben Yosef, who is... You never heard of Mashiach ben Yosef, right?
I'm thinking of Christian Mashiach, the way they see him.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
I was agreeing. His father was Joseph.
Yeah.
Different
jokes.
That's right.
Different last name. Interesting. So, the traditional understanding of Mashiach is Mashiach ben David, right? That's what everybody heard of. But the Gemara tells us in Masechta Sukkah that there actually is something called Mashiach ben Yosef. There's going to be a Mashiach who will be from the tribe of Yosef, who will die, and that there's going to be a great eulogy for Mashiach ben Yosef. So Rav Kook says, wait a second. This strange eulogy that appears in Zechariah is talking about a strange person that I never even heard of called Mashiach ben Yosef. Why do you have two Mashiachs in the first place? Did anybody ever hear of two Mashiachs? There's one Mashiach, Mashiach ben David, Mashiach Tzidkenu. So Rav Kook says, V'tzarech lahavin bechlal, I don't understand. Lama anu tzrichim l'shnei Mashiachim. Why do I need two Mashiachs? Mashiach ben Yosef, Mashiach ben David. Isn't the goal, next line, third paragraph, David avdi nasi lahem li'olam. David HaMelech is the ultimate king. So says Rav Kook, let's take a step back. Let's not talk about people. Let's talk about typologies. Types of people. And when we read this, by the way, some of us can self-reflect. Because we all know people who fit somewhere in these two typologies. Some of us are a blend, some of us are more in one side or the other side. Says Rav Kook, third line here at the end, Omnam ka'asher kishim sheyatzar Hashem Yisbarach, beginning of the fourth line of the paragraph. Just like God created ba'adam, in a person, haguf v'haneshama, Hashem Yisbarach created for us a body and a soul, Ula umosam, correlated to that, hakochos. What are kochos? How would you describe kochos? Strengths, energies, attitudes, predispositions, hanotim, that are predisposed, lahachazik kiyom aguf al mechono, to keep the body intact. So there's a part of us that says, stay healthy, be healthy. L'shachlolo u'lefoscho, to develop it, to make sure it's okay. V'chein, and so too, hakochos hamachazikim koach haneshama. The strength that goes with the neshama, to keep our spiritual, emotional, psychological comportment. We need both. V'tachlis hashleimus, what is the goal? It's after the little break here because of the page break. The goal is shiyeh haguf chazak v'amitz u'mufutach karoui. Our body should be in good shape. You know, when we round first base, we should be able to make it all the way to second base, Baruch Hashem. We should be in good shape, take care of ourselves. But at the same time, that's not the goal at the end. Vanishama, and the neshama, our inner soul, bria v'chazaka umeshuchleles, healthy and strong and developed, and that's going to drive all the kochos aguf. So we make decisions in life based on our neshama, based on our mind, on our heart, on our values. And then we have, please God, the health to be able to implement them. We have a value of chesed, so we should be healthy enough to do the chesed. We have the value of Talmud Torah, we should have enough equanimity to be able to sit and learn without being, you know, distracted or struggling with anxiety. All the things, says Rav Kook. This is the way that every person is meant to be. We need to have a healthy physical self to support a healthy spiritual self. This is what the Rambam points out, that the brachos in the Torah are primarily this worldly, because those give us the platform to be able to accomplish spiritually. A person, Rachman Lislana, we know this, a person who's not physically well, so they're not able to fulfill their spiritual aspirations very often. Sometimes it's the opposite, that people, they transcend their physical handicaps and accomplish spiritually. But the point is, says Rav Kook, that on a personal level, we have a guf and we have a neshama. Says Rav Kook, this is also true on the broader level. It's not just true for a person as an individual, it's also true for the Jewish people as a nation. Go down halfway down the paragraph. First word on the line is mitzuyanim. Leos ami kadosh l'Hashem Elokei Yisrael, that we should be for the nations of the world. Goy echad ba'oretz l'or goyim. We should be a nation which is strong, both physically and spiritually. So now Rav Kook says, initially, at the beginning, go to the next paragraph, mitchila, v'hine mitchila, initially, huchnu beis hakochus haklolios, these two overarching national qualities of having a strong physical body and having a strong moral compass, a spiritual sense of destiny, these two elements, they were planted within two tribes. Who are these tribes? Ephraim v'Yehuda, Shehu Kolel, Klal, Yosef v'Yehuda. Initially, there were two tribes who were leading, who were the two Bechorim, so to speak, for Yaakov Avinu. For the Bechor of Leah, it was Yehuda. He was the Melech. He was the leader. And from Rachel, it was Yosef. These two Shvatim represent these two Kochos. Which is which, if you had to guess before, don't cheat. Don't even look down, I see. Don't look down. Who goes with whom? Where do you think? Well, Yaakov is the father of everyone, but it's going to be Yosef and Yehuda. Who goes where? What's that? Yehuda is strength, but in which sense? Which sense? What a chazal, what's that? Why would you say physical? Interesting that you associate like that. Why do you say Yosef? It's true. It's interesting. Because on the one end, we refer to Yosef as the Bechina of Tzaddik. But if you ask somebody, what was Yosef's job? What was his mission in life? Even what he was dreaming about.
Yeah.
That's right. That's exactly right. He was dreaming about food. Why was he dreaming about food?
He had to feed the world.
That's right.
And his family.
Who? And that's exactly. Did you look on the page? Tell the truth. I'm not going to call people out. That's exactly what it says. Rav Kook says in the last line, Yosef hoya hamashbir, shever's food. Yosef worried about food. He dreamed about sheaves. He went to Egypt. He built a society, an economy. He was the mashbir. Right? Today in Israel, you go to the mashbir. Yosef was the mashbir. Yosef represents, for Rav Kook, in this respect, the tzaddik of the physical. Yosef's job, right? He was the, I don't know what they called him, the secretary of the treasury or the department of, you know, agriculture. He was the boss of all, he was the mashbir.
Didn't Yehuda have the job to go down to Goshen and set up the schools?
That's right. sure you didn't look? Well, we're going to find out afterwards. That's exactly what Rav Kook says. Lahoras lefan of Goshna, so Chazal associate Yehuda going down with spiritual leadership. Now it's true, as we said before, these are typologies. So Yosef was also a tzaddik, and the chiddush of Yosef was that even though he worked as a government minister, and politics can be a dirty business, he was still tzaddik, yisod olam.
Well, he always said everything was God, and because God planned
that, he brought it into these business dealings, exactly. And Yehuda was also the opposite. When he needed to step up on a physical level, David HaMelech was also a warrior. But be'ikaron, we associate Yehuda with spiritual leadership.
He said he should have gone.
That's right.
But it also fits that you first, Yosef had to go down to Egypt before Yehuda could go down.
Exactly. So it says, take a look on the next page. Turn the page over. He says, Yosef goes down first. Yosef is learning Chazav's tradition. Yosef knew 70 languages. He was very involved. There was a universal element that is associated with Yosef. Because guess what? Everybody needs food. Everybody needs society. Everybody needs civility. But fifth line, last one, two, three, fourth line, last two words, V'Yehuda miyuchad lekoach Yisrael hamiyuchad. Pasuk says, we recite this, we sing it when we say Hallel. Haisa Yehuda lekacho Yisrael mam shalosav. What was Yehuda's distinction? Yes, we need Yosef to bring sustenance, but we need Yehuda to bring the Ribono Shel Olam, the values, the ruchnius. That's the added element. So the goal is that everything should be together. Everybody should be together. But what happens? What happens after we finally settle into Eretz Yisrael and we build a base of Mikdash and we establish one kingdom that's based in Yerushalayim? How long does that last? Not very long. Because who goes and makes Shabbos for themselves? Yeravam ben Nevat, who was from Shevet? Ephraim. And all of a sudden now, you have two kingdoms. You have the southern kingdom, which is Malchus Yehuda, and you have the northern kingdom, which is basically, we could call Malchus Yosef. The Assyrians come. They take away the northern kingdom. It's a historical development, but what Rav Kook is trying to tell us is that we, if we look deeper, we realize there's also an element of the ore of Yosef and the ore of Yehuda that are now being fragmented. These two kochos, these two elements, are no longer working together. Rav Kook says, so much so, not only are they not working together, if you look in Tanakh, oftentimes, they were fighting each other. Rav Kook is telling us that when you read this in the Devar Hashem, what you're reading is, yes, it's a historical battle between the Malchus of the Northern Kingdom and the Malchus of the Southern Kingdom, but what you're seeing is the expression of attitudes. The attitude of Yosef, which says, we need to build a physical, we need to worry about our security from a physical standpoint, economic security, we need to worry about personal security, we need to build a land, we need to build a country, we need a homeland, we need a place to defend ourselves, we don't want to be the victims of pogroms anymore. You hear the language? That view, instead of being in tandem with the view says that the world is a makom of kedusha, a place of holiness, of Torah, of light, they start to view each other not only as distinct, but also as antagonists. And the citadel that says, we're going to build a Beis HaMedrash, Lahoros Lefan of Goshna, that starts to view the Yosef guys as, oh, you're misguided. You're morally bankrupt. And they've gone in two totally different directions. Each of these kochos says, Rav Kook, go down about 68% of the way down the page, or give or take. First word on the line is shahayu. These kochos, shahayu re'uyim, that they were appropriate lehis'ached dafka, to be together, hisril lehispateach b'fnei atzmo. They began developing independent of each other, and ultimately, they began to drift away from each other. What happens? Who gets exiled first? Ephraim, the northern kingdom. Skip ahead. Go all the way to the second to last page, the top column says Hatsura. I encourage you to read this on your own afterwards. It's absolutely fascinating. If you see the first word on the page is Hatsura, go down 80% of the way down. The first word on the line is Maisa Re'ehu. He says, let's go back to the beginning. We said there were two hespedim, two eulogies. Hadadrino Bebikas Megiddo. Hatchuna shel hachiba halu'umis. The quality of loving the nation. Nisgalsa ba'achav. Was revealed in Achav. Rav Kook quotes from a pasuk of Li Gilad. Achav, who was I don't know, would you call him a deeply religious man? Or how about you call him, yeah, maybe he was a shtickle misguided because his wife was a tsaris, but Lamaisa, you know, he had a lot of Christmas trees. Let's just leave it at that. Lowelane. But you know what Achav did have? He had national pride. He had national vision. He saw something about the Jewish state and the physical stature of the Jewish people. Who was the other person who was given a hesped here? Go down to the end of the page, right after that little space. Who is it? Yoshio Higbir Hatzad. Excuse me. Hatzad Haruchoni. Yoshio celebrated the spiritual side. Says Rav Kook, at the end of days, we will witness Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. It will be two stages. It will be the physical building, but that's not sufficient. It needs to be superseded, but built on top of the physical. It's like we say, the bracha, we ask the Rebbe Shlomo when we bench, Yolichenu komamius liartzenu. Komamius is two komas. Koma rishona, you would say in Hebrew, koma rishona, that's the first level of the apartment building. Koma rishona, that's Mashiach ben Yosef. That's Achav. Maybe Achav was a Rasha. Maybe Achav was a Rasha. But you know what? Even though he was a Rasha, he believed in the Jewish people, the Jewish state, the Jewish nation. He contributed something. There was some value there. And who is going to come and build on the next level? Koma miyus, the second level? Yoshio, yes, he was a military giant, but his goal was, and you could argue maybe, even greater than Chizkiyo, he was the greatest Baal Tshuva, the greatest Koach of Tshuva in Jewish history. The Pasuk says about him that he totally transformed the landscape of Jewish connection, of Jewish observance, of Yiddishkeit, through his Tshuva movement as the leader. 8-year-old boy king becomes biggest Baal Tshuva ever. Akadikach, they didn't have a Sefer Torah when he started. He didn't know what a Sefer Torah looked like. Says Rav Kook, what's the goal? That it should be kemispeid hadadrimon bebikas Megiddo, that these two forces should come together. He says, we're looking to a time, our goal is to see both of these unfolding. Next page, the last one before the English. Paragraph starts, Vihine betor ikva de Mashiach ben Yosef. In the time of Mashiach ben Yosef, Nisgala chizayon hatzionut bidorenu. Zionism has been revealed in our generation. And what are Zionists inclined toward? To the koach haguf, to the physical. That's true on an individual level, it's true on a national level. They're bringing to us, they're prioritizing, they're building the physical. Letzad hakloli biyoser. However, it's flawed. Umitzad chisaron hasharaso ena kochos misachtin. It's still flawed. Why? Because if the Zionist movement thinks that it is the answer to the Jewish destiny, it's only thinking about the Tzad HaChomri. It's missing out on the values and the spirit, the Dvar Hashem, the religious and spiritually meaningful life. So what we need, says Rav Kook, and what our goal is in life, is to build unity, to synthesize, and to bring these two forces together. To build a bridge whereby, instead of creating not just disparate worlds, and certainly not antagonistic worlds, the people who are building the chomer, who are going to the gym, are realizing they're building the physical on a personal and spiritual, on a personal and collective level, for the purpose of living a spiritual life, expressing the Dvar Hashem. And the people who are learning in the Beis Medrash should realize, Baruch Hashem, that we have people out there who, you know, they know how to fix things. They know how to build tanks. We need both. The goal is we should synthesize these two. What should we see? Ultimately, he concludes the Hesped, Ateres Tiferes Biyad Hashem, Utsnif Melucha Bekaf Elokim. Rav Kook writes in the letter to the Aderet, he said, you know whose name I never mentioned in my Hesped? That's right. He says, I never spoke about Herzl. I never mentioned Herzl's name one time in my whole speech. They asked me to come and speak. I spoke. Rav Kook says, did I know people were going to make a tzimis out of this? Yes. He says, I knew in advance it would be a controversy. Did I know that there were people who were going to twist my words? Because you know what happened the next week. The next week, people are running around Yerushalayim. Instead of poking people with needles, they put up big pashkavilim and they say, Kook says Herzl is Mashiach. That's the way it was represented in certain communities. Did Rav Kook ever say that Herzl was Mashiach? First of all, he never mentioned Herzl. But second of all, Rav Kook said that Zionism, and of course, this is Herzl's Zionism, represents part of the Jewish story. It represents the Mashiach ben Yosef in the sense that it is a necessary part of the Ribbono Shel Olam's plan. The same way that we all need physical sustenance, nationally we need physical sustenance. But the goal is that this nation, that this Am, should be one which is crowned with the crown of Yehuda. That ultimately Mashiach ben Yosef will die. So in a certain sense, if you really read the Hesped carefully, the Hesped was actually a veiled critique of the Zionist movement. But it was done in a way of respect, of love, of appreciation, of validating and recognizing the contribution that they're making. And at the same time, encouraging us to see bigger, to see higher, to understand that secular Zionism, while it is a contribution, that's not the end goal. Nobody wants to go to sleep at night and have on their bed little, you know, the blanket that says Achav. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's not who you want to be. You don't want to be that side of the Hesped. You want to be the Hesped of Yoshiyahu, the great spiritual reformation. Rav Kook is telling the people, he says, you know why I came to Yafo 3 weeks ago? You know why I'm going to go to Rehovot, and I'm going to go to the Moshavot, and I'm going to sit with these people and hold their hands? Because I believe that what they're doing is contributing to the future of the Ribbono Hashem, of the Ribbono Shel Olam's will, and I'm going to encourage them to see the next level, to see how what they're doing is actually just a stepping stone. It's just a building block for the Mashiach ben David, for the ultimate Yeshua, and that's what we're really waiting for, and that's what Rav Kook was encouraging us to appreciate.